This is Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. We hope you'll stay tuned. Chris Mayen, our history correspondent, is here joining us from Chicago for the first time in the year 2000. Chris, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you for having me.
Chris, we're moving into a new century. I mean, here we are, and we've been over the last year or so examining the history of the United States, looking at the similarities and differences between our time and earlier periods. And we're going to be talking today about kind of juxtaposing and comparing and contrasting the beginning of the 20th century with the beginning of the 21st. What was the beginning of the 20th century like?
Well, in some ways, there were some eerie parallels between the beginning of that century and the beginning of this one. If you look at American society, United States of North America society at that time, you had a situation where you had had, in the 60s of the previous century, this tremendous turmoil over the race question. Then you had the development after that, a tremendous expansion of the economy, a tremendous expansion in population, new productive forces being introduced with the steam engine and the factory system and railroad production, railroad transportation. So the new century begins, it's a period of tremendous monopolization. Just a couple of statistics. By 1904, you had a situation where at one point there had been more than 1,000 railroad lines, and those had been consolidated by 1904 into six great rail combinations. You also had a situation in the same year, 1904, where you had 318 trusts with a capital of more than $7 billion that controlled 40% of U.S. manufacturing. So the result, then, of this monopolization is that you have two things going on. One is that you begin to have the outward expansion of United States imperialism, with particularly the Spanish-American War, the conquest of the Philippines and Puerto Rico, and with the Platt Amendment, the reduction of Cuba to a neo-colony. So you have that process. You also have a real intensification of the class struggle within industry, within the factories of the United States. And this period between the turn of the century and the beginning of the First World War is a period of very, very bitter economic struggle, marked by things like, for instance, the formation of the Industrial Workers of the World in 1905, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in New York City in 1911, the Ludlow Massacre in Colorado in 1914, and in 1915, the execution of the labor martyr Joe Hill.
Can you, there's just something that I'd like to go back to. I mean, for one thing, I mean, I'd like to, if you could, share with us a little bit more about these specific events, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire and the Ludlow Massacre, and also the execution of Joe Hill. But you use the term trust and this sort of consolidation of wealth. And I'm thinking, you know, these trusts, were like corporations, sort of same thing?
They were essentially monopolies, yes. I mean, you would have, like, a situation where there'd be a sugar trust, or there would be an oil trust, where almost the entire control of that industry would be in the hands of one corporation or of several corporations, which are essentially controlled by the same people.
There was at some point where was actually a great outcry against these trusts. I mean, even in what would have been referred to as the sort of mainstream corporate press of America at the time, correct? I mean, it was recognized then that these things were getting too much power, correct?
That's correct. What begins to happen is that the situation becomes so outrageous and so obvious that people, certain forces in the country, begin to advocate reform, not from really a standpoint of humanitarianism or certainly not from a standpoint of revolution, but simply because they begin to realize that, look, if we don't cool it a little bit, if we don't modify things somewhat, we're going to have a revolution on our hands. And so you have the beginning of what's called the Progressive Era, and you have, this is marked by particularly the election of Theodore Roosevelt, who is referred to as a trust buster, and who under his administration begins to support legislation such as the Meat Inspection Act, the Hepburn Act to regulate railroads and pipelines, the Pure Food and Drug Act. And then later, also under Taft and under Woodrow Wilson, there are other reforms as well. But I think the attitude of people like Teddy Roosevelt is summed up in something that happened in 1910 when, at that point, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that New York's workers' compensation law was unconstitutional because it supposedly violated the constitutional provision about depriving someone of property without due process of law. And Teddy Roosevelt was furious at that decision of the U.S. Supreme Court, and he said that this decision added immensely to the strength of the Socialist Party. That was his comment on it, that we can't have the Supreme Court ruling these sorts of measures illegal or people will become socialists. And he was right about that. But that's why he was supporting workers' compensation.
We're talking with history correspondent Chris May, and we're currently talking about the period of American history, the Progressive Era. Chris, let me ask you if we could, because we can talk more about the Progressive Era, but I would like to if we can, because, I mean, some of the specifics that you cited, the Industrial Workers of the World, the Ludlow Massacre, I've heard of that, of course, the execution of Joe Hill. I'm not familiar with the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. Can you talk about some of these specifics that you've given to help give our listeners, and myself for that matter, an idea of what these events were?
Okay. Well, in 1905, you had the formation in Chicago of an organization called the Industrial Workers of the World. And that essentially was an organization of some socialists and people coming from an ideological direction, but mainly people inside the industrial system, workers, lower paid workers, unskilled workers, workers who were committed to a very militant kind of trade unionism, who were absolutely opposed to the style of trade unionism of the American Federation of Labor, which was organization by crafts, where within one factory you would have sometimes 5, 10, 15 different unions. The Industrial Workers of the World's position was that in each factory you would have what they called one big union. And they were a very, very militant organization. They often had to fight for their right to strike, fight for their right even to engage in free speech. And they would have campaigns where if someone was arrested for speaking on the street in one city, they would mobilize all the wobblies, as they were called, from around the country, and they would just jump onto trains, onto boxcars, and find their way to the city in question and fill the jails. They would speak in public and get arrested and fill the jails until such time as the original person arrested was let out and the right to freedom of speech was established in that area. So they were a very, very militant group, and they had a very distinctive style and energy. They also tended to be very opposed to politics, any kind of politics or any kind of compromise, and ultimately they were destroyed as a result of repression at the beginning of the First World War.
There is, as I understand it, somewhat of a resurgence of the IWW. I mean, I don't think anywhere near what they would have been, but it seems that organization is active again, to some degree at least.
There are chapters of it in various parts of the country. That is true.
We're talking with Chris May, and our history correspondent. Chris, you were also going to talk about the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, the Ludlow Massacre, and the execution of Joe Hill.
Yes. Well, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire was a fire that took place in New York City in a garment factory where opposition to or in violation of even the very minimal safety rules of that time in New York City, there were doors that were locked, doors that when they were supposed to be kept open during the working day, there were doors that did not open the way they were supposed to open for safety purposes, and where the conditions in this garment factory were just absolutely terrible in terms of the crowding and the fire hazards, and as a result there was a fire in this garment factory in 1911, and when the New York Fire Department came there with its hook and ladder fire trucks, the ladders could not reach up to the area where the fire was most intensely burning, and as a result of that, many people, many young women garment workers, were burned to death. Some of them leapt to their deaths, and this created a great shock throughout the United States, and the memorial services and marches for the victims of that terrible fire were one of the things which led to the development of International Women's Day as an international labor holiday.
It's amazing when you talk about these various issues and how clear it is how much struggle and how much fight has had to go into just even getting the barest of concessions. I mean, when you can have, I'm assuming had this factory not caught on fire, we would have never heard about this, but these type of conditions were going on across the whole spectrum of industry, correct?
I think that's true, yes.
Can you talk a little bit about the Ludlow Massacre?
Yes. Well, that was an incident that took place in Colorado where you have a situation where there was a tremendous battle going on between the miners and John D. Rockefeller. And it ended up in great bloodshed where the thugs of John D. Rockefeller essentially opened up fire on these striking miners. And then when the one section of the gun battle was over, when they were searching the area where this fighting had gone on, they found a number of bodies of members of miners' families. And that, again, is something that just shocked the United States.
And you were going to finish up this portion of our discussion with the execution of Joe Hill in 1915.
Yes. Well, Joe Hill was one of the leaders of the industrial workers of the world. He was also a songwriter, and he wrote some of the most famous ballads of that era. And one ballad mocking preachers who promise, you know, pie in the sky by and by, but don't respond to the conditions of poverty on earth. And he was a leader of the IWW, and he was accused of having killed someone in a store robbery in Utah in 1915, and never really proven guilty of the charge, but there was a situation where he didn't really have, in the kind of environment, the hysteria of opposition to the IWW at that time, he didn't really have to be proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and despite a tremendous international campaign to stop his execution, he was executed in Utah in 1915. And since then, I mean, before he died, he made this famous statement to one of the other principal leaders of the IWW, Big Bill Haywood, the statement to the effect, "Don't waste time mourning, organize." And that became a watchword of the labor movement at that time and ever since. And since his death, he's been certainly one of the martyrs of the labor movement in the United States and the world.
This is Full Logic Reverse. We'll be back in just a few moments. We're talking with art history correspondent Chris Mann. Chris, we were talking about the progressive era as a whole before I sidetracked you into these other things, and I really appreciate that you were willing to do that. Do you see certain parallels between that era and the situation today?
Yes, I do. I think that the parallels are that in both cases, well, obviously you have chronologically a new century. You have the tremendous development of the economy as the result of new productive forces. At that time, you have the steam power, the industrial system, that new productive force. I think today we have the development of electronics, of robotics. And as a result of these new productive forces, you have tremendous wealth being concentrated in the hands of a very few people. Now, this situation is getting so extreme in both cases that both at the beginning of the 20th century and today, where certain social forces and certain political representatives of those forces are saying, wait a minute, maybe we better do something to sort of cool things. I think it was interesting that last summer, David Gergen, who's a former White House communications director, he was an important official in both the Reagan White House and for a while in the Clinton White House, and he's now one of the editors of U.S. News and World Report, a weekly magazine, came out with an editorial about Clinton's poverty tour that he took last summer, and he talked about the growth of poverty in the United States today and the contrast between the existence of poverty and this tremendous accumulation of wealth in the hands of people like Bill Gates. And he said that, well, maybe what we need is a progressive era again. Maybe what we need is, as he put it, a Theodore Roosevelt for the information age. So I see certain political representatives in the United States today looking at what was done in the progressive era and wondering whether that sort of thing, that sort of modifying of capitalism to make it less extreme or to round the rough edges off of it shouldn't be done again today.
You know, that's very interesting because I'm also thinking about the whole experience of the World Trade Organization in Seattle, and as a result, in part of what was happening outside, and of course also in part due to what was happening inside the meetings, we had President Clinton, in essence, I think, doing the same thing that you're talking about here, where he was acknowledging that if they didn't try to modify what they were doing and the way they were going about it, is that they were going to be heading for more trouble that would make what was happening in the streets of Seattle look like small potatoes to some degree. I mean, does that make sense to you?
Very much so, yes. I think that there are sophisticated representatives of the ruling class today who look at a situation where you have 1.5 billion people on this planet who live on less than a dollar a day, and they say to themselves, well, you can't have that and have the tremendous accumulation of wealth in the hands of these billionaires and not tinker with that somewhat. But again, I think we should remember that just as Theodore Roosevelt was against the Supreme Court decision about workers' compensation because he didn't want to increase the strength of the Socialist Party, so these people are taking these positions precisely because they want to preserve capitalism, not because they want to destroy it.
Well, point being, of course, is that they're not doing this for any, as you had used the term earlier, humanitarian reasons. It's simply going, oh boy, we better do something or else our whole house of cards is going to start crumbling from under us.
Right, exactly.
We're talking with Chris Mahan, our history correspondent. Chris, you talked a little bit about some of the similarities. What about some of the differences between the progressive era and today? I mean, is a new progressive era or progressive era 2? I mean, is that even possible?
Actually, I don't think it is possible because while there are some superficial similarities, I think that fundamentally the two situations are very different. I think it's very important to remember about the progressive era that there was a foundation for reform in the United States. And that foundation was that the the ruling class of the United States was able to move outward at the same time that they were starting to pass these different regulatory acts in the United States, the Pure Food and Drug Act and so forth, and the workmen's compensation laws and so forth. At the same time that they were doing that, they were expanding outward into the Philippines, deeper into Latin America, into Puerto Rico, turning Cuba into a new colony. And as a result of that, they were able to extract super profits out of the workers of those places. And it was those very super profits that allowed them to give the working class of the United States something. Really, it was a form of bribery, you know, of saying to the workers of the United States, we'll give you these good wages, now shut up about what we're doing in the colonial and neocolonial world. And I think the important thing to remember about today is that today you don't have that same situation of imperialism. We have a fundamentally new economy, a fundamentally new stage in the development of capitalism, the stage of globalization. Many people see this as just an intensification of imperialism, but I don't think that's really the case at all. I think that globalization is a different stage of capitalism than imperialism, and what globalization does is that it abolishes these distinctions between the colony or neo-colony over here and the mother country over there, and it evens out the conditions of labor. It tends to drive the level of wages of the workers of the so-called mother country down towards the level of the workers in the neo-colonial world. And as a result of that, I don't think that there can be the kind of progressive era that there was at the beginning of the 20th century, because the objective conditions just aren't there for it. There could be a Teddy Roosevelt who supported workmen's compensation in the United States, because that same Teddy Roosevelt was going into Latin America and, in his famous statement, you know, walking softly and carrying a big stick. You know, he could be a rough rider in Puerto Rico and a supporter of workmen's comp in the United States. But today the situation is a situation where you have demonstrators in Seattle facing the same rubber bullets that demonstrators in South Africa and Northern Ireland and the West Bank have faced over the last 30 years. So we're seeing an evening out of the conditions.
So the point being is that we could have a Teddy Roosevelt, be it for the progressive era or the information era, who could support workers' compensation rights in the United States, because that workers' compensation was in essence a bribe that was being paid for on the backs of the people in the colonial areas. And if you don't have that type of relationship anymore, I mean, everybody's a colony now, so there's no bribery left to be had, is basically what I'm hearing you say.
I think that's the historical direction, is that the conditions of the workers in the former, quote, mother countries, unquote, is being driven down towards those workers in the former colonies. So there's this evening up. I mean, I'm not saying that it's necessarily gotten to a point right today of absolute evenness, but that's certainly the direction, and certainly the bribe, if it can be said to exist at all, is declining very, very rapidly.
We're talking with Chris Mahon, our history correspondent. Chris, if the type of reforms that were being utilized in the progressive era inside the system aren't possible, then what are we looking at for a solution? I mean, is there one?
Well, I think the situation that we're faced with is that the rulers will not be able to tinker with the system successfully. I mean, they may attempt to do something like the progressive era again, but it's simply not going to work. And so I think that what we're going to see is, under this system, an intensification of this process where you have an accumulation of wealth at one pole of society, a few millionaires and billionaires who amass tremendous amounts of wealth at one pole of society, and an increase of misery at the other end of society. I mean, this is the process has gone pretty far already. When you have a few hundred people who are billionaires who have an amount of wealth equal to the entire gross domestic product of China at one side of society, and then you also have at the other end of society 1.5 billion people who earn less than a dollar a day, the process has gotten pretty extreme. And we can anticipate that this process is going to continue, that the rulers are going to attempt to fundamentally to hold on to control of society by force, and that is then going to create a situation, I think, where there's just a tremendous obligation on the part of conscious people, people who sense that something's wrong, to mobilize the great majority of humanity against this tiny handful of people and to take political power away from them. And I think that that for people who care about the future of society and who, as we enter this new century, want to make it different from the previous century, our obligation is to wake other people up, to agitate them, to point out that we do have, while we don't have the possibility of another tinkering with capitalism like the progressive era, we do have these tremendous new productive forces, just as they had new productive forces at the beginning of the 20th century. And I think our charge should be what Jack London said in 1906. There's this wonderful statement where he said in the book The Iron Heel, he said, and he was talking about the productive forces of that era, but I think it applies to the computers and robots of today. He said, "Let us not destroy those wonderful machines that produce efficiently and cheaply. Let us control them. Let us profit by their efficiency." And I think and he said that is socialism. And I think that's our charge today, is to, for people to step forward in society and say, we can have a world without hunger, we can have a world without homelessness, we have the technical capacity to grow food almost virtually overnight, we can build houses in a matter of hours, so let's get rid of this capitalist system and do that. And the organization that I'm in, the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, that's what we're about. We're about bringing that question to the public and agitating people about that. And if people would like to get in touch with us, I can tell your listeners how they can do that.
Please do so.
Well, you can give us a phone call at 1-800-691-6888. Or you could write to us at Post Office Box 477-113, Chicago, Illinois, 60647.
Chris, can you give the phone number one more time, please?
That's 1-800-691-6888.
We've been speaking with Chris Mahan, our history correspondent, and once again, I felt like it's time well spent, Chris. I felt like I've learned something again and look forward to having you on the program in the future, and we can continue walking our way through history and also using that to find out where we stand today.
Well, thank you very much, and I really enjoyed doing this. I'm looking forward to the next one.
All right. Chris Mahan, thank you for joining us on the program today. Thank you for joining us for this edition of the program today. I'm your host, Mike Thornton, and it's been my pleasure to be part of the team bringing you Full Logic Reverse. If you'd like more information about FLR, you can contact us via email, flr@jps.net, or by telephone, 530-271-0804. We invite you to join us next time for another edition of Full Logic Reverse.